think most of you know who I am and what my interests are. As you probably have heard me say, my name is Fred Kramer. I'm interested in development of people. I'm interested in, particularly because of my background and experience, interested in the way college students develop. And the way college students develop has relevance not only for those of us in education, but for everyone, because the stages that college students go through in their educational development are similar to the stages that all of us go through in some degree or other. I'd like to report today on some very interesting research, I think, that gives us some new understanding on how people, or how students particularly, think about the areas of authority, knowledge, and belief. It's a study on the changes in college men and women during the ages of 18 to 22, particularly as they look at what is authority, what is knowledge, and then what kind of a faith system should they develop. This research was done by a psychologist named William Perry, and I think that's a name that those of you who are working in education are going to be hearing more and more about, because I think that this is important research, and it is a part of a research that's now going on more and more in terms of the whole question of how students and people develop ethically, morally. There's a whole school of research that's is looking into the question of moral development now. Kohlberg is one of those persons. Perry was more interested in intellectual development, but as he got into the question of intellectual development, he found that he could not separate it from moral and ethical development. Well, the basic conclusion of his whole study, and interviewing I think it was 31 students for a period of 4 years, interviewing them every year in May. Not he, but he had a whole team of people who had worked very carefully together to interview and develop kind of ways of approaching and trying to find out what had happened in a college student's life during that year, how he or she had changed and grown, particularly as it related to how they looked upon their college education, how they were growing intellectually. They did a very careful kind of analysis and training interviewers, and then they had people who judged the interviews. And out of this very careful and intensive kind of evaluation, they came up with a way of dividing and tracing the development of students through 9 stages, they call it, 9 intellectual stages. And their main conclusion was that people move and must move, if they're going to develop intellectually, they must move from a dogmatic approach to authority, that is, an approach that they call dualism, that is, everything is right or wrong. There are no grays. Students come with the and they could have gotten this from the kind of value system that their parents gave them, that, or from a faith, a religious belief, that they have accepted what people have said without any kind of processing themselves. They have accepted it, not because they have thought it through or because of any act on their own, just because authority has said it is true. And authority said it is true, and so it is true. And so everything is good or bad. Nothing is better or worse. There are no gradations. It's either good or bad. It's we or they. Everything is looked upon either or. There's no middle ground. It's either right or it's wrong. And most students, though, go through this stage earlier in high school, and by the time they get to college, they no longer think in those kind of definite black or white terms. But his conclusion is that people have to, the natural progression is that they go from this stage of looking at things dualistically, black or white, into a stage that they call, three stages they call, realizing that that relativism in the world is an important description of the world. That is, that you begin to look at things relatively, and you begin to see that there is another side to this, and there is another side to that. And you begin and this is particularly true of students who begin to be exposed to some new ideas and some new instructors, some new faculty members who open their eyes to different points of view that they never even had heard about. And so but what happens then is there's a painful transition, obviously, from going to college and accepting authority and saying that authority is right. And then you get into a classroom and you find that you have different authorities, and you find that an instructor is presenting this point of view of one philosopher and this point of view of another philosopher, this interpretation of the Bible and that interpretation of the Bible. And this shakes people up, obviously, because there is then really confusion. There is no one authority. There seems to be so many authorities that it becomes painful in moving and giving up the kind of easy way that you have of looking at things when everything is definite. And so these stages here are just kind of gradations of people that move away from looking at things dualistically to a point where they begin to look at things in relative terms. And when they get to the middle, which they call stage five, that's where people are so relativistic that they reflect the point of view that every idea is equally valid. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. His idea is as good as my idea. That expert's as good as this one. That religion is as good as another. Whatever people think, I mean, people can think whatever they want. Everything is relative. And, of course, the danger, and this is the frustration I think that many parents face when they hear their children, young sons or daughters, talking that way, they get very frustrated. And sometimes people, in a sense, get stuck in that area. They either then are not willing to move on and develop a belief system of their own. They just begin to say everything is relative. There isn't any absolute truth. No matter, there's no really right or wrong. It depends on the situation. And there are people that get stuck in that area. But most of the students, most of us, move on to the next stage. You begin to see that although this is a very pluralistic world and there are a lot of different points of view, it certainly is a relativistic society, a lot of things are relative, that you begin to feel that somehow you have to develop some kind of a foundation, a belief system that sorts that out, that gives you some kind of sense of identity. Because if you look at everything, if you look at the world as if everything is equally true, this is a very anxious kind of world. There's no security. There's no way to move. So people do move to the next stage, which they call the evolving of a commitment. And this means that that people begin to discern that there are some things, even in a relativistic society, that are more important. There are some values that are meaningful to a person, and they begin to develop and integrate. But then they begin to recognize that there are other authorities, but they decide to accept one viewpoint, one value system as their own. And this is what, in terms of, they make this distinction in terms of religious terms, that the people are moving from belief to faith, that we are all raised with beliefs that we accept. We begin to go through the question of doubt, and it isn't until we have doubts as to whether what we believe is true or not that we then can internalize and begin to decide that, yes, I will accept something, and then you move on to faith. And you move on to a commitment. Developing commitment means that one develops a kind of a sense of wholeness and integration of one's life, that, and he may be committed to a career, to other people, but he not only has a commitment, he begins to see that you have to give yourself to something, to your fellow man, to a relationship, to something higher than himself. And as you move that way, you begin to find, well, that's very difficult to do. It's easy to have that kind of philosophy, but the contradictions in life, the challenges of trying to develop a commitment and then live that commitment as a whole person is very difficult. And it isn't really, I suppose, in terms of the ultimate nine, where people have somehow faced all the difficulties of developing a commitment. They have tried it out and it works for them, and they have developed a wholeness, a sense of integrity in which their values, their faith, and their sense of integrity, their sense of personhood is one. That's very brief kind of description of what they found that the stages that students go through. And their thesis is that everyone went through this. I mean, they didn't find any exceptions. If they could, with careful evaluation, put people, men and women, at various stages here, and they could trace the development from their freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, and that by the time they were juniors or seniors, that most, I think it was almost two-thirds of the people were up in this category. Some students, as I say, find that they're unwilling to make a commitment, and for whatever reason, they retreat. And I suppose there are many people in society that do retreat today. They look upon, and you've heard people say, well, you know, all religions are equally good, and so I'm not going to get involved in them, because whatever people think are important, that's all right, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I found this study interesting because I think it does have some, it has certainly some implications. Any of you who have taught people, most teachers have this ideal in their mind that they're going to come into the classroom and they're going to present some stimulating ideas, and students are going to respond, and they're going to kick off and they're going to get excited about it. And but most often, students come to a classroom not with the thought of being learners or as independent people who want to learn, but they come to a classroom with the idea of, okay, I'm here, teach me. And so they're looking to the teacher as an authority figure. They want the teacher to tell them what is right, what is true, what they should think. And they fight trying to think for themselves. Well, you can have, say you have a group of 20 students in your classroom, and you have some people in your classroom who have this kind of fixation on authority, that they believe that there is some absolute truth, and that if only the instructor would lay it out and tell them what it was, then they could write it down and they would have the answer. And you have some people like that who expect the instructor to give the answers, to lay it, to simplify it, to not confuse them with a lot of vagueness, to not confuse them with trying to think about the complexity of things, but to give them a simple answer. You have students in a classroom who are looking for that. You have some other students who are looking at the world in terms of everything is relatively true, and this is a stage for faculty. They like to teach people who have got this kind of an openness to all ideas, because that's a good state to be in at some stage in the sense of being an instructor. You have somebody that responds to new ideas and thinks, well, everything is important. And some students, and an instructor dealing with these different kinds of students, will frustrate if he takes an approach that says, everybody go read something for themselves and learn on their own. The students who want the instructor to tell them what the truth is, they're going to be very frustrated, because they don't want to go search and struggle and find it for themselves. They want it laid out for them. I think that what the scheme says is that education must be more conscious of the fact that people come to college in different kind of stages of development, intellectually we're talking about now, and so that what works with one person in terms of a method of instruction will not work very well with another person. So I think that has some implications in terms of how you approach an educational situation. What you have to do with people who are looking at authority as absolute and having all the answers, you have to help them grow beyond that point. You have to begin to expose them to different points of view and have them see that there are different ways of looking at things. But you have to do that gradually. You just can't throw them in the cold water, so to speak, and expect them to swim by themselves. I think this has implications, for instance, even in terms of the whole question of rules and regulations in college. We've moved very, very fast in the last 15 years away from the concept of in loco parentis, which is a way of saying that colleges were seen as being responsible for the student outside the classroom in terms of his or her development. That is, they were acting as parents instead of parents. And so people who sent their sons or daughters to college with that expectation expected the college to act as parents to tell students what they could and what they couldn't do. We've moved away from that into a much more of an atmosphere of giving students responsibility for what their own personal lives. The problem and the dilemma that colleges have faced in this whole area is that some students, and many students, are ready for the freedom and responsibility because their parents have given them a foundation in which they can make wise choices. And they don't need very much guidance, except a reinforcing kind of environment that helps put forth positive values. But there are still some students who come to college expecting that mother or father is going to tell them what's right and what's wrong. And so that kind of a dilemma that colleges face in terms of how do you take a community of people who come with all kinds of, are at all stages of development, and provide experiences that are going to help each of them grow. Well, sometimes somehow we have to find the kind of ways that encourage people to risk and grow and to develop some ability to analyze things, and yet at the same time provide a supportive kind of community. I think another thing that would seem to be an important conclusion of this study, which I found particularly interesting, that they say that you can't separate intellectual development from moral development or ethical development, that it's all of one pattern, and that means that educators, as many faculty professors would prefer to take the stand, they have many times said that they're concerned about the intellectual development of students, and that what a person does with his intellectual skills is really not the responsibility of a faculty member, that the best a good faculty member can do is help students develop skills for thinking and analyzing, and what a person does with those skills is really a moral question, and that faculty members or people in college shouldn't really try to shape students that way, because that's an individual thing. It's a question of faith, a question of belief, a question of their own moral standards, and that we should be very careful when we try to impose our moral standards on someone else. And so there's been a tendency to say, we can only go so far. We can only go as far as helping people develop intellectual skills, and then it's up to them. But I think the conclusion of this study is that if you really are going to help people grow, you have to begin to help them with this problem of commitment, to find ways to help students to come to commitment. They become committed to something that's beyond themselves. I think this also has some implications. I was trying to think about this in terms of even our approach in education in the church. Well, let me cite a criticism that we've heard, and all of us who've been in colleges hear from parents who say that their sons and daughters came to college with what they thought was a good, strong faith, and that the college succeeded in raising so many questions that they left confused, and they gave up their faith. Perhaps that says something about the way we should approach education, because I don't think we're going to change our educational institutions. We can't change the nature of education. Education, by its very nature, is continuing to widen horizons for people, to have them gain new knowledge. And the more new knowledge you gain, the more complex things become, the more questions you raise in your mind. And if you're not prepared to do that and move through all these complexities and try to then sort them out and find some answers that mean something for yourself, then you're going to be frustrated and unhappy, and you're going to sometimes retreat from this complexity. And some people don't want to move beyond this. They want things laid out and clear, and so they don't have to think about it anymore. And perhaps I have the feeling that we have a real dilemma in Christian education, because obviously we have teachings that we believe are true in the absolute sense, and we, as part of our catechism training and our education, we want students to believe these things, and so we develop a system that has people learn this, and we hope that young people then incorporate this as part of their belief system. But I'm concerned that in doing that, we don't go the next stage and help people, especially young people, teenagers, who at the same time they're getting the absolute truth from the church are being exposed in the world to the fact that everything is relative. And so they begin to in the church they're told to look at things and not question things, and outside society they're told to question things. And perhaps we have to find better ways in an earlier age to help students see that even within the church that we still are questioning, that there are different interpretations and different ways to look at things, especially there are different ways to interpret what Christ teaches mean in today's society, in today's world, and that sometimes we avoid that very difficult transition that students have to go through, when they have to begin to develop their own intellectual skills, and they have to question and they have to find out for themselves. And if we can't help them through that stage, if we expect that just a view that authority says it so, and so it must be so, that's not going to hold, that's not going to help many students. Now, it depends again in terms of whether students have not only accepted these beliefs in Christ as part of their, as something that they're told, but whether they've incorporated that into their life. And if they have incorporated it into their life, then they'll, I'm sure, withstand the doubts and the problems. But if they haven't, if they've just absorbed it as an intellectual belief system, then they're going to have problems. And so I don't have any answer to this. I just point it out as a dilemma, and I just like to throw it out now for your own reaction. I think, as I say, it is an important study. I think it shows that in God's scheme, man is a growing person, that we've been put on earth with skills, with intellectual power to learn and learn and develop a society, a very complex society. We have the ability intellectually to grow a great amount, but that what we do with that intellect is pretty important. And if we don't move from just using our intellect for developing new knowledge, if we don't move it into the area of committing ourselves to something, that we've really failed ourselves and society, and we failed God's mission for us. Well, that's...
You have described to us the process of education in the higher, college level. what would you say the difference would be in this process for a state institution that has no commitment to any religion, as state they just have to the educational process, and a college maintained by the church?
Well, obviously there are some important differences. I think that for a state institution, it's harder for them and harder for faculty members to say that they have an obligation to help people move to some kind of a development of a moral point of view. Instructors will say that the main idea of a university is to present knowledge and the students can absorb it or not. And yet, even most state universities would say that they have some higher purposes too, even though it's not related to having people develop a faith system. It is that they want to develop whole people, integrated personalities, good citizens, people with a sense of integrity, and that these, while they're secular goals, are also goals that are relative here. So that in terms of Perry's distinction, he would, I think, argue that the difference between secular institutions and church institutions is really one of a question of what you want people to have in the way of faith. That a secular institution still has the obligation and should have the aim of helping people develop a set of values that are going to let that person succeed and develop in today's society. Obviously, the church has the same mission. It wants students to develop that. But in addition, it wants students to come out of college with a strengthened faith. But even then, this is a difficult dilemma too, because again, even though the colleges are part of the church, part of Christian education, they do not see as their mission certainly imposing faith on students. So they still have to use the same approach to help people open their intellect up. But believing that the kind of models of faculty members and the total environment will, and the Christian atmosphere will, have a greater impact on helping people to develop a faith and value system that is related to the Christian faith. But it's a question of degree and kind, both, I think.
Fred, looking at what I would describe the end result there, and trying to address myself again to Fred Schutz's question. If I followed your presentation, it really should be the philosophy or the goal of a secular state university, and that would be the faculty primarily, to give the student an opportunity to hear both sides of the question and so forth, stimulate his realization of relativism, and then have him come to a conviction, a commitment. You use the word commitment. But whether that commitment was a commitment to, well, let's just say to a communistic philosophy, that ideology, whether it was a commitment to statism, a national thinking that the state is supreme, really, as far as his moral or maybe even religious life is concerned, that is no particular concern of the professor. If he has followed this and has practices academic freedom and allows a student to practice academic freedom. But what he evolves into, I was thinking about that. The thing that I think it would rule out would be that this final student would be an agnostic and wouldn't know, wouldn't have a commitment necessarily to anything. But now, to make my point, in contrast to that, wouldn't it be the, I'm going to use religious language, the hope and prayer, the real goal of a Christian institution, that in that final stage, he would be, to use theological language, committed to Jesus Christ. He would be a committed Christian. Whereas that could not, even according to the separation of church and state, and we won't get into that, it's not isolation, but according to our fundamental conception of a free church and a free state, that could not be the goal of the institution. It might be the prayer of that individual professor. And one more little remark, and then I'm through. And I suppose that if this man, and we have a big hassle about this, about which you know a whole lot more than I do, is suspected of being a communist or a fascist or something like that, but what his deep convictions are, I don't see how it could keep, or if he's a committed Christian, I don't see how that can keep from rubbing off on the student a little bit. I said it was the last word, but it was next to the last word. I heard a definition of teaching that I thought had some validity. Now, you're an expert in this, and you can be glad to have your reaction to it. That really teaching is the impress of the teacher's personality on the student. Now, whether that's educationally correct or not. But really, that's incidental to what I try to say, is the distinction that between the final goal that I tried to make there, perhaps in a blundering way, is there any validity to that?
No, I think that that's a fair way of stating the difference. Mm-hmm.
I got my college education in a church school, and of course, usually you have a course in religion, and you have daily chapel. One of the things that meant most to me in that period of education was that now and then a professor would digress in dealing with the material in the course, so that it was obvious that he was giving a witness to his faith. And I remember one day we got Professor Oki Rauho to speak at Luther Lee. Well, he was a great professor when it came to Ibsen, Scandinavian literature. It was a thrill to sit through his classes. But in this address at the Luther League, he spoke about Christian baptism and what it meant to me. And to this day, that's one of the finest addresses I have ever heard on Christian baptism. Well, that being made, whereas he was a professor of literature, exercised a great influence. Well, I was pastor for 6 years at Moorhead, Minnesota, where on one side of town you've got Moorhead State College, the other side of town you've got Concordia College. And I was invited up to give a daily, or not daily, weekly chapel talk at Concordia. And I felt that I had an obligation to the Lutheran students over on the other campus. And in talking with some of the faculty, that administration set up an arrangement whereby from time to time they had pastors in the city, different pastors, speak to the students, had a convocation, wasn't called chapel, and they could speak as they wished. And this did, I think, something for the students. And they encouraged students we had a Lutheran Student Association group, voluntary. And we had several faculty members who were advisors, and they took an active part in being advisors. And in those groups, as in for Methodists or Presbyterians, they discussed the Christian faith and its effective, so that there was a lot of help in that way for them to make commitments and to move out of a commitment to relativism to a commitment to the Christian faith. Went so far as, this is not an obligation, but one day I met the professor of biology from Morehead State College. He was coming down the street on the other side, and I was on this side going, and I was about to salute him. Then he crossed the street, and he said, "Reverend Fred, I've got a problem." He said, "I've got a book in biology that I would like to use because it's one of the best that I've found. But," he said, "this author teaches evolution as an avowed fact." Now, he said, "How would your people feel about that?" He said, "The Lutherans." Well, I said, "For you to determine what textbooks you want to use, but if you're asking me that question, I'd have to say they wouldn't be very happy about a book of that kind." "All right, I won't use it," he said. Well, the spirit was such that there was a respect for the Christian faith. And when I spoke at commencement exercise one time, one year, President McLean introduced me as the chaplain for the Morehead State College. Well, there are lots of things if you deal with them not as a group of heathen because they happen to be a state institution, but they are people, and many of them are avowed Christians, although they have to deal with this in a different way. They make you a part of their family, as it were, and that for the students becomes something of a commitment.
Yes, I was. I started my career actually at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and as I was an activities advisor, and one of my responsibilities was really to be the liaison and to help support and work with the university religious workers. We had a group of organizations which were the pastors of the different foundations, the rabbi, priest, Protestant ministers, who every few weeks we'd get together and talk about the religious community. And so I think it is true that state institutions do try to foster and support an environment in which students have an opportunity. The philosophy is that they should be exposed, that this is part of life, important part of life, and that they should have an opportunity to pursue their own faith, to be exposed to different students with different faiths. So that it isn't really fair, I think, as many people say, to say that the state institutions aren't concerned about religious growth, because they are, and any of you who've worked in
it. I don't agree with you there about really. My grandson, just from old personal experiences, wrote a term paper on in psychology, and he had Christianity in it, and he got a big red zero for a grade, and the professor wrote, "This is not a class in theology." And it just mentioned Christianity in a few during his term paper. So I really don't agree with you there.
Well, I'm not saying that couldn't happen. It doesn't happen in many classroom situations. In fact, it happens. I think that you may even get that kind of a response from some faculty member in an English class or a sociology class, in which, and this is part of, I think, the challenge of trying to help students go through the process of learning. Sometimes, without trying to make any judgment in the case that you're talking about, the students really don't respond to what the faculty member is looking for. The faculty member is looking for the student to look at a variety of points of view and give some pros and cons to try to understand this point of view, even though you don't believe it, and to understand what a Marxist person thinks, what a capitalist person thinks, what a socialist point of view. He's not asking what you think or what the Christian point of view is. He's asking what that person thinks. And one of the problems in terms of education is that students have to learn to respond to what the professor wants. But, on the other hand, and this is the point that Perry makes, that instructors who are not sympathetic and don't reply in a positive way to people who, when they do affirm their own belief system, can be destructive, because there was obviously some miscommunication there. The student wasn't doing what the faculty wanted, and instead of giving him an F, the faculty should have gone back and wrote some notes and explained why it was that what he or she did was not appropriate for that particular. That's, in fact, a kind of a telling comment here, that one of these students said that the high point of their educational career was when they got a paper back with just a little point, this phrase, nice point. I mean, it wasn't just an A, B, C, but that instructor had made a personal response to what the student had said. And this is obviously a need in terms of education, that we need. The thing that I think that also comes through here is that you have to begin to look at students as individuals, that people are at different stages, and you have to be able to react and help them develop. I think the difficult thing for us, I think, as Christians to accept is that education seems to require people, if they're going to develop themselves, to go through these stages, that they have to go through this stage of relativism. They have to begin to look at things as if everything is equally right at some stage in their life, that you can't kind of just jump from belief to commitment without going through that stage in which you have to wrestle with ideas yourself, you have to kind of sort them out, you have to develop your own kind of philosophy. That's painful, but that, I guess, is what growing up in society means today.
Fred, do you feel that relativism would be the best title for that? Maybe it would be something more like doubt, and relativism being an expression of that doubt? Or do you feel, or does the study feel, I guess is my question, that there has to come that point where a person feels that everything is valid? Can you get through that stage just doubting that what you've always believed isn't quite right without actually taking the step and thinking that everything is right?
Yeah. I don't think that you have to go through the stage that you automatically move everything is equally, but you have to begin to look at things. You have to begin to at least accept the fact that for instance, there is some validity for people who study Buddhism, that this, you have to at least try to understand what they're saying. You don't have to accept it, but you have to get through the point of trying to understand it before you can reject it and say, it's not for me. You can't just reject it without
understanding. So sort of sympathetic exploration.
A willingness to explore, not giving up your own basic values.
Did I hear you say then that's part of the problem of the church is not in their teaching of people, the young people that they come, as well as the older members, that they're not willing to teach with that openness, that the problem of the church then is that they teach in a very narrow, kind of a tunnel vision? And then that the students, when they do hit this kind of thing that you're talking about, and that's when they're shook up and it doesn't last for them.
I think that's happening for some students, because I think it's a question that they begin to, they look on authority as having the answers. And then when authority, and this being the church or the Bible, even though the college doesn't question that directly, they begin to say, you know, that free enterprise is not all good. There are some problems with it. Even democracy is not all good. There are some problems with it. When people begin to think in those terms and see that there's another side to everything else, they begin to see there's another side to what the Bible says sometimes. And if you haven't begun to be prepared to how do you sort these things out, when you begin to reject authority on in social and political issues, you also begin to reject authority in religious issues too.
So if there's a more broadening in base in the teachings that the church is if there's a broader base than in the teachings that the church is dealing with not just the young people but anyone, then there's a less chance of this attitude changing when they're confronted with situations in college or whatever.
That seems to be the implication, and I think that coincides with my experience in dealing with young people. And one of our problems, of course, is the fact that so many young people do drift away, and many don't, obviously. Many go through this stage and reaffirm their commitment and continue as strong Christians through the college age and into young adulthood. But many of them do. At the point where they're beginning to search and say everything is equally true, then they reject the basic belief system too. And unless you've helped them to come through this stage, I think that they may falter along the way.
Well, I'm going to step right in again. Only a fool steps in the ancient spirit of tread, they say. And I'm one of those fools, I guess. But I just want to give out a personal expression on some of this. When I came to Norway the first time up there, I've been waiting there for 50 years. My elder sister turned to me one day and she said, I know that you believe in this Jesus business. This is exactly, I'm using her word for it. And she said, I believe in God, you know. She said, I believe in God, you know. But she said, all the rest of that is pretty sticky. And I said, Ruth, I'm not the evangelist, nor am I a trained minister or anything else. And I said, you were confirmed. You went to public school, and in Norway you have at least 1 hour of religion a week, and the Methodist friends stay away from it, you know, and that the Lutherans had to attend it. And you did take your confirmation instruction and got your hearing, which you have to have in Norway, you know, you have to, the pastor can tell you, you have to stand up and testify to what you had learned. And you accepted a nice big party by your parents, and relatives and friends gave you gifts of both money and presents. And at that stage, you apparently, because you stood before the altar and said that you forsake the devil and all his evils and prayed to God. And I said, since I cannot possibly give you any more than that, outside of my own life and my own satisfaction of being a Christian, that Christian involves being a committed Lutheran or committed Methodist or Baptist or whatever, that has nothing to do with it. And I think that we should also forget about the sectarianism. If we are telling someone to come to Christ, we should forget about telling them to come to the Lutheran. End of it. It is necessary, in my estimation, but this is just the point of view. But I said, as far as I'm concerned, I cannot set you down and say, Ruth, here, this is what you've got to believe. Because you have had the opportunity, you have looked at it, and whether you have rejected or whatever you have done, or if you are on the verge of coming to it, I can tell you what will help you. Prayer. Go to your friends that believe and ask them what satisfaction they get from that belief. That I can tell you, but I cannot say, well, this is something you must do because you are an individual just like I am. And I think that's where I hold the American teaching method. No religion should be mixed up in the education, that there should be always an open door. And that is our responsibility as Christians, to see that there's an open door for those people in those confusing years. When they think that, well, I belong to Marxist belief, I'm going to divide everything I have, and then you say, all right, give me a billfold, how much you got in? And then you get down to reality, and then they shake their head, and that is the way I meant it. That it's an idea.
Don't you think when a person responds as your sister did, that she is eager to get an argument going? I think I would have asked her, well, what do you mean by this Jesus business? And let her uncover a little bit to then pry with other questions as she would tell.
I wouldn't insult her intelligence.
Oh.
I have two thoughts. I'll say one thing first, and that you see this, you know, especially as in evolving in kind of college age kind of life. I think actually this is something that probably is in emphasis then, but yet kind of continues on. Like it's when we think about ERA, when we think about the environment and all these things, that is something being done to help college students to kind of realize this process so that they can carry this on throughout their lifetime? That's question one. And then another is values clarification is something that is, you know, has come into, you know, usage quite a bit. And do you see that as a valuable thing, or is it more of a superficial thing?
Well, let me respond to the second one. I see values clarification as useful, as a useful tool, because I think it does force people to be pinned down a little bit as to what is important, and I think that people are reluctant to kind of analyze what their value system is. So I see any kind of education that helps people put their own self out and try to understand what makes them tick as important, because I think that if you don't become involved in your own education, it's not going to mean very much. You can just be a student, a professional student, that is, without any attempt to try to integrate what's happening, what you're learning. And so what was your first comment? Oh, you were talking
about if they realize, if they understand the process that they're going through, so that this can kind of carry through, and you know, they can think of this as something to use throughout their lifetime, or something that happens. I don't, yeah, it's something that you just, you know, down.
Well, I think that I think that students do understand that once they've gone through it, I think that they can look back and say, you know, they can see how I've changed, and how I had so many doubts and so many questions, and then I began to see that I needed to sort them out. I needed to get some priorities, to develop a value system that meant something to me. And when they have done that, if you talk to a student who, in a sense, is a student expression, who has it together, has got it all together, it's a joy, really, because those people have somehow integrated a faith, a religious belief, a sense of a purpose for their life, have no fear of developing warm interpersonal relationships with other people, and they seem to have, you know, have somehow struggled through all these different kind of problems and have come out as a fairly mature and forward-looking person. Getting back to your question, I don't think that colleges are set up, frankly, in university or most educational systems, to be aware, as much aware of this as they should be. I think those of us who work with students in a counseling way, or as I've been a dean of students, particularly sensitive to this, because we have kind of always taken a holistic point of view. We see students in terms of the whole environment, because we're kind of responsible for them in terms of their development outside the classroom as well as inside. And so we've always thought that the faculty did not look upon the total student as much as they should. And I can't be very optimistic. I don't know whether education is moving that way very fast or not. I think the pressures of the specialization of knowledge are such that the highest priority is being placed on an English teacher learning more and more English, and a philosophy teacher learning more and more philosophy, and a biologist learning more biology to keep up in the field. And they don't have as much time to look at how students develop and help those students understand how they're developing. But good teachers have always done that intuitively, I guess, and have looked at the individual where they are and have tried to help that student grow. And that, of course, is still happening in many places.
Yes,
well, yeah, that's what I didn't say. We've got to give you a few moments to
yeah.
Remember, we have a 12 o'clock setting today. Yeah. So that's it.
Thank you.
That was very interesting.